And it really is a great honor to be here. When Rabbi Brand mentioned a year ago that he wanted me to be a virtual shliach, I said, oh, virtual is fine, not a problem. I have to wake up sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning and somehow look awake enough to give a shiur, but that's easier. And I thought that when he said, okay, no, maybe he'll come around Yom HaTzmud or on Yom Yerushalayim, I thought, okay, that's a nice optimistic dream. And besides COVID issues, I thought it would be very complicated. It is very complicated, but it really is it's a very good surprise and a very good opportunity to be here. So for those random 3-4 people who might not know who I am, my name is Ephraim Rimmel, and I am 37 years old. And life was relatively regular, not up until 2.5 years ago. But before we get to that, I want to start with a short video. I'm pretty sure some in this room were actually participated in this video as well. Despite the fact this story started 2.5 years ago, the story really started 37 years ago, but definitely almost 16 years ago when Tzipi and I got married. We have 5 children: Itai, who is 14; Leah is 12; Amichai is almost 10; Havel is 6; and Noam, our baby. And again, life was relatively normal, mundane, nothing ordinary. Nothing out of the ordinary, nothing too special. We were here on Shlichut for 4 years, from 2010 to 2014. And when we came back, Tzipi was a teacher, was a college teacher. I was the regional director of the youth movement in Israel. And life was good. Life was just fine. And 2.5 years ago, December 1st, 2019. We went to Yerushalayim for a family get-together. The grown-ups, we went to a restaurant. The kids stayed by my aunt's apartment. They were watching a movie, had pizza, like any other regular Saturday night. And towards midnight, we went back to the apartment. Itai was already sleeping on my aunt's couch. I remember picking him up and putting him into the car. And we started driving home. In the car was Tzipi and I, Itai, who was celebrating his 12th birthday, and Noam, our daughter, who was 3 weeks old. And we started driving. We get onto the Begin Highway. For those of you who've been in Yerushalayim, I'm sure you've been on that highway. We connected to Highway 443 towards Modi'in, and we get to Tzomet Machane Ofer, right outside of Yerushalayim, the connection with Givat Zeev. That junction has 4 lanes. The left lane makes a left into Givat Zeev. The right lane is a right turn into Machane Ofel, which is an army base. And the 2 main lanes go straight northwest towards Modi'in. We stand at the red light. And that's the last thing I remember. The next thing I remember is when I wake up in the hospital. At that point, I didn't know that, but it was 2 weeks later. And my glasses were not on me, they were broken. So it took time for Dr. Rubin to make me a new pair. So in the meantime, I'm trying to figure out where I am and what's going on. And so many people in the room, and I'm trying to get into the conversation. And the rumor that I woke up spread relatively quickly. And one of the doctors comes into the room and says, "Ephraim, you know who I am?" I said, "No. Who are you?" He said, "I'm Dr. Schwartz." I said, "Oh, nice to meet you. I'm Ephraim." He said, "Yeah, I know. You know why you're here?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, there was a car accident. How do you feel?" At the time, I was getting very heavily medicated, so I was feeling great. I said, "Everything's okay. Thank you." He said, "Do you remember something from the accident?" I said, "No." He said, "Okay, you know, I see we have lots of people here. We'll talk to you later." In the meantime, people were coming and going, and I thought it was morning, because usually I wake up in the morning, but it was towards the afternoon or evening, and people were really coming from all over the place, and I don't know if it was because of the drugs or just I was in a good mood, so I guess it was a little bit funnier than usual, and it was next time everybody was just chatting around. And towards 9:30, 10 o'clock, visiting hours were over, everybody had to go home, and I stayed with one friend, with Avi. And I noticed that, I realized that I didn't talk to Tippi. She didn't call, she didn't come to visit. Thought it was all off. But that's okay, she has 5 children, she has what to deal with. I probably did something stupid, and she didn't have time to come take care of it, and she'll come in the morning. But I see so many people, I'm so excited to see that I'm awake. So I said to Avi, "You know, give me your phone, I'll call her, let her know everything's okay." He starts giving me these random excuses. "Can't talk on the phone in the hospital, it's bad for the machines, and I forgot it in the car." I'm like, "What are you talking about? Just give me the phone, and I'll be short." It's like, "No, you shouldn't do that." And I'm saying, how cheap can you be to not give someone your phone? So I remember that the last Shabbos before the accident, I thought it was a day or two before, I didn't realize it was 2 weeks. His son had a bar mitzvah, and I thought maybe after the bar mitzvah he went a little too overboard, and the financial burden of giving me a phone call cost him too much. I thought maybe he had the wrong package. It didn't make any sense to me that he would cheap out on a phone call, but I couldn't think of any other reason. So I said, "Okay, you know, I'll try one more time." He said no again, so forget it. You know, he'll have to leave at some point. Somebody else will come. And we get through the night, Avi leaves, Netanel comes in the morning. I said, "Netanel, can you believe this? Avi was so cheap, he wouldn't give me a phone. Can you please give me the phone? I want to call and say hello to Tippi." He said, "Oh, sure, no problem. But I see the doctors are coming in. You know, we'll let them have their cupboard and give them your attention. And then afterwards, I'll give you the phone." That's fine, that makes sense. The doctors come in and do their rounds, and lots of doctors come in. And it felt like 1,000 doctors came in. It was the head of the trauma, the head of the ICU, the head of the surgeons, obviously the surgeons themselves, the nurses, everyone comes in, checks whatever they feel is what they need. And the head of the trauma, the same Dr. Schwartz from yesterday, says, "Frank, remember me?" I said, "Sure, we met yesterday." He said, "Right. Remember why you're here?" I said, "Yes." He said, "There was a car accident." I said, "Good. Remember what happened?" I said, "No." He said, "Nothing?" I said, "No. I think I might make something up, but I don't think I really remember." "No, you don't have to. Don't worry about it. We'll finish our rounds. We'll come back." In the meantime, my parents came in. I forgot about the phone. And a few minutes later, Dr. Schwartz comes back into the room, talks to my parents for 2 minutes on the side. And my father sits to my right, my mother sits to my left, and they're holding my hand that way for sure for the first time since that video we just saw before. And Dr. Schwartz says, "The accident was a little serious." I said, "Okay." He describes the surgery I went, the surgery I had in my stomach, the surgery I had in my back. And he says, "You know, we're not sure, but we think you might not be able to walk anymore." I was surprised. I did not think about that. I didn't feel my feet, but after 2 weeks of induced coma, you don't really feel the rest of your body as well. So I didn't really understand that it was that bad. But, you know, he said it in such a way where it's like, "No, we think, we're not sure, we don't know." And, you know, I felt that my thumb wasn't strong enough at that time, so I wasn't that worried about it yet. But before I even had time to ask any questions, he said, Itai is fighting for his life. And that's a phrase that I've heard, you know, on the news about soldiers from, you know, in the battlefield or unfortunately from terror attacks. But my son, 12 years old, is fighting for his life. What does that mean? Who's he fighting against? What is he doing? What does that mean? And before I had time to ask anything about that, he tells me that Tzipi and Noam were killed on scene. And nothing prepares you to hear the worst news you could possibly hear. And he gives me a few minutes to try to catch my breath and try to, I don't know if you understand it, but at least try to for a few minutes. And the first question I ask is, was the accident my fault? And he said, no. I said, doctor, come on. You know, you were able to tell me everything else and this is too hard for you. Tell me what happened. I'll manage. I'll deal with it. He said, no, I'm just telling you the way it was. You know, there's a police report already. There's the cameras. According to the police report, you stood at the red light, and the driver hit you at 110 miles per hour straight ahead, which is obviously a little bit more than double the what you were allowed to drive on that road. So okay, and then a couple more seconds later, what about the other kids? Where are they? Three kids stayed home with a babysitter that night. And at that point, my in-laws were moved into my house for taking care of the kids. My parents basically moved into Shaarei Tzedek and were with me in the ICU, with Itai in his ICU. And a little bit gives me a few more minutes and said, well, just before I let you go, just have to deal with one more issue. I said, okay. We're debating, we might have to do another surgery for Itai. And he describes to me Itai's situation at the time. They already amputated his left leg beneath the knee. He went through intense surgeries in his stomach. They already took off a part of his skull and all kinds of other issues. And he says, we're debating if we do another surgery or not. I said, doctor, I have no idea what you just said. I didn't understand half the words in any language, and you know, whatever you decide sounds okay to me. And Bezat Hashem, he said, "No, this isn't a doctor decision. This is a parent decision." Because Itai was he was declared or announced as a chole hanoteh lamut, a sick person who is leading to die, and. That's not only a medical term, it's also a halachic term, where even though it's clear that they want the surgery to do good, unfortunately in surgery sometimes bad things happen, and when you're in such a delicate situation, we don't touch them, because even though we want to do something good, maybe something bad will happen. And so it's up to me to decide. And the week before, they already had to make this decision when I was sleeping. And doctors and the rabbis were sat down and decided that, no, we're not going to do the surgery because it's too delicate a situation. And when I wake up, they think maybe we should. And they asked for my ruble, and I said yes. And after the surgery, they realized that if they would have done it earlier, it would not have been good. But if they had done it a little bit later, it'd be even worse. And through this entire craziness, I was trying to think or comprehend, what am I supposed to focus on first? Am I supposed to focus on my rehab? Am I supposed to focus on Itai's situation? Or on the loss of Tzipi and Noam? And I remember then a line I heard from, a phrase I heard from my Rebbe, Rav Amital, Rosh Yeshiva Gush, and he had a saying, She'elah tova, adifa mitshuva lo tova. A good question is better than a not good answer. And the first time he said that, I thought he was talking about the shear. He gave a shear, and he asked a question, and one of the guys gave an answer, and he didn't like the answer enough. He said, hey, you know, my question is too good to give this not good enough answer. No, he was insulted in the name of his question. I gave a good question. Give me a good answer. If you don't have one, we'll stay with the question. And a few months later, on Yom HaShoah, Rabbi Mittal, as a survivor, always gave a very meaningful talk. And he said the same thing about the Shoah, about the Holocaust. He said that during the days of when they founded Medinat Yisrael, they used to say that the founding of Medinat Yisrael is the answer to the Shoah. And he said, I don't accept that. I don't accept that answer. And I don't think it was because he didn't appreciate the miracle of Medinat Yisrael or that his Zionism wasn't strong enough. He said, 6 million. The question is stronger and better than any answer that you could give. And for the first time in my life, I understood what he meant. Because I don't know. I don't know the question. I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know why this happened, or what am I supposed to do with this, or how I'm supposed to deal with this, or what am I supposed to do with, how am I supposed to continue now? And I don't think I'm righteous enough that I am going through this nisayon, and I don't think I'm wicked enough to deserve this kind of punishment. I don't know. I don't know why, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. And it's weird not to know, because nowadays we ask Google anything, and we get 20,000 answers in less than a second. And even if we don't like the first or second answers, we scroll down to the fourth or fifth one, whatever fits our agenda. And you can't do that. There is no answer to why. There is no answer to how am I supposed to deal with this. There is no answer to how do you move on. And the pasuk that we read, the after of the fast days, that Hashem's paths and thoughts and ways are not ours, gets a much stronger and deeper meaning. And I understand that I don't understand. And I know that I don't know. And again, even though it doesn't make sense or it doesn't make it easier, it gives it some kind of an understanding of what I'm going to deal with. And with that notion that there are things that I will never understand, and there are things that I will never know anymore. With that notion, I heal, so to speak, enough. 2-3 weeks after I wake up, about 5 weeks after the accident, and I move to the rehab center in Tel HaShomer. When I get to the rehab center in Tel HaShomer, there's a meeting with the doctor. It's called a Sichat Rofe Bachir. You talk with the senior doctor. And if I have to compare it, it's like a parent-teacher's conference. Usually in parent-teacher's conferences, the teacher tells the parent how the student is doing, if he's meeting his potential, or definitely in my case, usually in high school, not meeting his potential, and what we might have to do. And the doctor does basically the same thing. He describes my prognosis. It's paraplegic, you know, the whole long description of all the things that come with that. And basically you have to do everything, you have to learn how to do everything with your hands, from sitting up in bed, to getting dressed, to moving, transferring to the chair, to bathroom, shower, everything you could imagine, and probably a little less. And he tells me that the potential is to be independent, but on a chair. And I said to him, that seems a little weird. If you're independent, you're not on a chair. If you're not on a chair, you're not independent. He said, trust us, that's what we do. You know what we're doing, that's your potential, and I think you should be able to handle it. I said, okay, but what are the chances of me getting out of this? He said, I don't like saying numbers. So I didn't ask for 72% or 39%. No, give me a ballpark, he said. And if it's 99-1 and you're the one, so if it's 99-1 and I'm the one, I'll think somebody has it out for me. But if it's, you know, 50-50, you know, there's a chance that maybe yes, a chance maybe no. Hope for the good. He said, I really don't like to say numbers, but it's closer to 1 to 99. I think you should start to get used to the chair. I remember leaving this parent-teacher's conference with my father, And we've been to some intense parent teacher conferences in my life, but this is obviously a little different. And even though Shari Tzedek prepared me that this might happen, and obviously he heard even worse the first couple of weeks. When the verdict is official, it obviously has a much stronger impact. And we start rehab, and I remember going into the physical therapy room. When I get into this room, I see that one of the guys is being measured for a wheelchair. For those of you who've never used a wheelchair, you assume that all the wheelchairs are the same. There's a chair, there are wheels, and that's it. Those of you who've used it know that every chair is very different. The width, the height, the depth, the kind of tires, the back system, everything is personalized. Yeah, usually you have to take measurements and send it off like to Italy until it comes back. It takes a couple of months. So I say to my physical therapist, okay, when are we taking my measurements? And she's like, you sure you're ready for that? I said, well, you know, the doctor just said I'd have to use a wheelchair. If you don't think so, then I'm fine with that. But he said, I do. He said, no, I think you'll need a wheelchair as well. I said, okay, so let's move on. The hospital wheelchair is horrible. It's heavy. It's just not comfortable. She said, you know, but the guy that they're taking this measurement from, he's been here already for 10 months. He's leaving next week. This was the first time he was willing to sit down and take measurements. I said, so why didn't you explain to him that he needs a wheelchair? She said, he did. And I didn't understand what he didn't understand. Because for me, dealing with the physical aspects of my injury was the easiest of all things to deal with. At the end of the day, I'm here. I was able to get on a plane, fly across the world, get in and out of pretty much every car. And I didn't bring it here today, but there's plenty of you who have already seen me. I have this scooter that I could drive around with. That hooks onto my wheelchair. I take my son to kindergarten with it, and all of his friends are very jealous because it's much cooler than any car that any of the other parents have. And there's ramps, there's elevators, there's many ways to overcome a physical problems, especially nowadays. Yes, there are things I can't do. I can't go up steps, not even one. I can't go on heights. I can't run a marathon. I wasn't really planning on doing that otherwise. But everything else, you have to do a little bit differently, but you can do it. I remember the first time we wanted to go to a restaurant. So obviously I called to make sure that it was kosher, that it was open, that COVID, inside, outside, takeaway, whatever it was, I forgot to ask if it was accessible because I didn't think of it then. And I got out of the chair and I wheel myself towards there, and then I look up at those five steps that look like Eiffel Tower, which is pretty much the same. But even then, there was like a path from the side that I was able to get into, and even if there wasn't, I probably would not have been hungry. I probably would have found somewhere else to eat. You know, so everything has to be planned and everything you have to make sure is really accessible, but there usually is a solution. There is no solution to the fact that my children now have to grow up without a mother. That's much more difficult. And a father that obviously can't do as much as he used to before. And if Leah had her bat mitzvah earlier this year, I'm sure she did not plan of having a bat mitzvah run by her father. And that's much more difficult. Even more difficult than that is dealing with Itai's situation. For many months, we didn't know if he would wake up, and if he would wake up, what would it be when he would wake up, what he would be able to do, what worse, what he won't be able to do. And obviously, even more than that is dealing with the loss of Tzipivit and Non. So to me, I really couldn't understand why this guy was trying to avoid sitting on the chair. Just, no, whatever they give you, take it, move on. A few days later, I went to talk to the psychologist, and I think I never spoke to a psychologist before. I think in high school you have to speak once to the school counselor at some point. I probably did that, and that was it. And I go into the psychologist, and he tells me, Fryam, how do you wake up in the morning? And at that point, physically, it was difficult for me to sit up. So I said, you know, the nurses come, and they help me sit up, and they put like this piece of cloth underneath me, and they pick me up with what looks like a crane, and they sit me down in the chair. Now, it seems very easy, but back then it was very complicated. He's like, no, Dad, I know. How do you wake up in the morning? So I don't know the last time you stayed in the hospital at 7 o'clock in the morning when the shift of the nurses change. It's very loud. You wake up. He's like, okay, so turn around to the other side, put your, you know, put the covers over and go back to sleep. I said, oh, I didn't realize that was an option. 9:30, I have physical therapy. I have to daven, eat, get dressed, take a shower. I don't have time to mess around in bed. He's like, I'm not saying that's the option I would choose, but you know, there are people who do that, who try to avoid getting out of bed. I said, well, it's clear to me that if I'm here, then I have what to do. I have to get home for Itai, for the children, for myself. But obviously, there are things I need to do still, and I gotta go do them. I have to get back home. And I think that's what maybe that person really didn't understand, that person who trying to avoid his wheelchair. He didn't understand what else is left. What else does he have to do? He tried to think that, okay, you know, life is bad and that's it. He didn't understand that if he was able to overcome that accident that he was in, that there's still what left for him to do. But how do you do that? How do you overcome so many challenges? Each one of them being maybe too much, and all of them together seem very heavy. So I don't know if I have the winning recipe of how to deal with it, or if it's the right way or not. I could just tell you how I've been dealing with it the last 2.5 years. So I want to show you another short clip. Some of it is in Hebrew, but I remember Reb Engel's, most of his Rosh Hashanahs are in Hebrew, so I'm sure you'll be able to figure that out. Questions my father asked me the first couple of days after I woke up is what do I do in reserve duty in Miluim? Question seemed a little off because I understood that I probably wasn't going to go back to Miluim very quickly. I said, I'm a staff sergeant. I said, how many soldiers do you have? Around 30. I said, well, while you were sleeping, there were 400 people who said they were soldiers of yours in Miluim. So, I'm not a battalion chief. I don't know where all these people came from. But people were coming from literally all over the world. And I hear that they're talking about lists. And I'm like, what are these lists about? I said, well, we don't want everyone to come at the same time, so we have people signing up. Okay, so one list. Why do you need to have lists? Well, friends from the yeshuv, from the yeshiva, from the army, from work, from we don't know where, so we put in a different list. And people are coming all the time. One of the nurses asked me, you know, isn't it hard on you or difficult for you to host so many people? I said, I'm not hosting anyone. They come by themselves. They even bring their own food. I don't have to do anything. She's like, well, okay, but you still have to sit and talk to them. I said, okay. So, but then you want some quiet time? I said, quiet time There's way too many, way too much. And I think when you understand that, so many people really want to do something and give you chizuk and just be there with you. It really does. It really gives you a lot of strength knowing that you don't have to deal with the most difficult time of your life by yourself. You feel lonely, but you're never by yourself because really everyone is there with you. One of the other nurses asked one of my sisters, who is this patient, said, he's my brother. Yeah, it's so you all look alike, but who is he? And like a good younger sister said, Ephraim. Ephraim, nothing too special. And she's like, no, that can't be. I don't know who you are, but I recognize half the people who are coming here because lots of them are famous or more famous. And how is it that so many people are coming? And until today, I have lots of people on my contact list on my phone, which I never dreamt I would have their number. And they could call me, and they send me messages, and they come to visit, and they get a phone call saying, well, I happen to be in the neighborhood. Nobody happens to be in the neighborhood where I live. And all the time, these things could happen. And it really does give you a lot of strength knowing that you don't have to deal with all this on your own. You saw that one of the messages, for those of you who read the Hebrew quick enough, there was a sign-up, a link to say Tehillim. And that specific link to say Tehillim, there are more than 65,000 Prakim of Tehillim that were said. Now, I don't know 65,000 people. And even if every person I know said 10 chapters of Tehillim, I still wouldn't get to that number. And I know that many of those Prakim were not said through that link. I would assume that the Prakim said here in our Torah were not through that link, or anything that was said on Shabbos, or anything that was said, you know, in other kind of gatherings. So how do you get to that number? How does it spread such a way? Obviously, everyone that I know said it, passed it on to everyone that they know, who passed it on to everyone that they know. The next story, if it wouldn't have happened to me, I wouldn't believe it because I'm a little too cynical for it. But it did happen. Towards the end of my time in rehab, there was a bunch of friends got together, and because of COVID, they couldn't do it in a restaurant, so we had to do it in the lobby of a hotel. And I get out of the cab, and I start rolling towards the door. And this random guy, I don't know who he is. You know, he sees someone on a wheelchair, and he feels a little awkward. He doesn't know what to do with someone in a wheelchair. That happens lots of times. But he opens the door for me. And he's like, starts to mumble, he doesn't know what to say. So he asks me, where are you from? I'm not sure it's the first question I would ask. But I said, I'm from the Beit Zuf. He said, oh, do you know the Rimmels? I said, yes. He said, Frank, Svi Moshe, Vitru, David, Siga, Ita, Yaakov, and Sibora, you know who they are? I said, yeah. He said, how are they doing? I said, they're doing better. He said, you know, because we've been dominating for them, we've been thinking of them, and anything else we can do, please see. I said, no, you're doing great. I promise to pass it on. You know what you're doing. And again, this really sounds, that doesn't make any sense because, you know, this is the 21st century. You're saying, telling about someone for 6 months, you know his name and his mother's name by heart. You would figure out that when you meet him face to face that you'd understand that who it is. But obviously, our mutual friend or our mutual friend told them about the story, and he said, well, I got to do something. And he started praying to him. And it's just an example of, you know, many times when I've said the story, somebody comes over to me afterwards and said, I've also been doing that. And really, it's just an example of how much Am Yisrael wants to do something. And many times people ask me, what can we do? And the answer is, not much. No one in the world has found a cure to spine injuries, and I don't expect the person asking me what can he do to be the one to find it. But we all know someone who needs something. We all know someone that could use a phone call, a visit, a text message, daven for him, or anything else. And many times we feel like, oh, I can't do anything, so I won't do anything. But that's not true. You know, just send them a message. Give them a call. And those little things really leave an impact. One of my first conversations with my mother-in-law, she asked me if my friends knew, if she knows how to cook. Without getting into mother-in-law jokes, I said, I would assume so. She said, well, the amount of food that comes here a few times a day, I think you don't think. I can pull it off. I said, okay, I'll tell them to dip it down a little bit. But it still happened. I could get a knock on my door, like 5:30. Did we eat dinner yet? So, no. Okay, good, because we were making dinner, and accidentally we have 3 pizzas for four garlic breads, a pot of soup, and, you know, dessert cut up in a plate. But again, because people just want to do something, and they feel that this is what they can do, so they do it. And when we finished fixing up my house, and we moved into my house, we moved back in, so one of my friends said to me, Ephraim, we want to invite you to your house for Shabbos. I said, I don't think that's how it works. So he said, well, you know, our house is not accessible, your house is, so we'll make the food, and we'll bring it over. Now, what did that, we didn't ask him to do anything. You know, he made the same amount of food that he would make if you would come to him. But instead of me being the one that's the needy or has to be picked up, and it is comfortable, it isn't comfortable, or with the bathroom, no bathroom, whatever it is. So he took the same pots and walked 4 or 5 doors down. And now, not only am I with him, I'm the hostess. I make Kiddush. I'm the Abba Shel Shabbat. I run the show. And it's small little things like that that make you, give you that special feeling. But I think, above all, our Itai's friends. You saw the clip of the first time Itai came home about six months after the accident. And he got this royal welcoming. You know what? He deserved it. He wasn't on a cruise. He was fighting for his life, literally. And you know, the first time, they threw candy at him. There were signs all over the yeshuv. It was great. But also today, 2.5 years after the accident, every Friday night his friends come over after dinner. They take him out to hang out with the guys. Shabbos afternoon, they pick him up. They take him to Bnei Akiva. Motzei Shabbat, they come to our house. They play on the Xbox or whatever else they're doing. And he's back in all the WhatsApp groups, and, you know, it's just one of the guys. And a few months ago, when there was a special Bnei Akiva celebration with Dagdanut. How do you say Dagdanut in English?
Flex.
Give me a break. Flex. Something with flex. It's like a dance with flex, I guess, would be a good way to say it. So he kind of participated, as if every Dagdanut has flags and a wheelchair coming in and out. And if there's something that really does comfort, really does give you comfort, is knowing that Itai is back to being one of the guys. And even though he can't play soccer with them or run around like he used to, he's still just one of the guys hanging out. That's really something very special. I mentioned before that there's a saying that "Hachayim chazakim me'achor," life is stronger than anything else. The will to live, the fighting for your life, is stronger than anything else. Why? Why is that? What's so special about this life that is worth fighting for? Maybe sometimes it's too complicated. We try to do our best and. That's it. Let's move on or give up. I think the answer is based off of a pasuk that we read, you only read it a few weeks ago.
We read it a little bit more.
In Parashat HaChemot, the Torah says, that the mitzvot, that we should do them, we should live according to them, and live according to them, and Yeshem. The matter says, "V'chay b'hem v'lo she'emut b'hem." You should live by them and not die by them. And that's why pikuach nefesh is doche all the averot in the Torah, besides the capital three. Why those three? I could think of a few other special mitzvot or important mitzvot that we have in the Torah. So Rav Hirsch in his Pirush on the Torah explains that those three represent the most important or the minimal for us as Jews, as human beings. you know, obviously Gilui Arayot, the minimal of morality, Avodah Zarah, the minimum between us and Adam and Makom, and Shfichut Damim, the minimal between us and Adam and Chavero. And he says that Kedushat HaChaim, the Kedusha of life, is based on the fact that you live a life of Kedusha. That you have to make sure that your life are is sanctified, and if not, then maybe your life isn't worth it. But those three, those make sure that we always are on the Kedusha level. We're on a high enough level that it's worth living. Therefore, you have a very devotion. You should do anything and not violate those. If I have to translate that into a modern word, I think the word is significance. We live a life that has to be significant. And we want to be significant, and we are willing to fight in order to be significant. And every one of us is significant. Everyone is significant in their family, in their jobs, in their communities, for Klal Yisrael. And in order for us to continue to be significant, we are willing to sacrifice. We're willing to overcome challenges that we think that we can't overcome, because it is important to us and it's meaningful for us to be meaningful. And even though if I'm not here, the world will not collapse, but my special meaning can only be given by me. And I'm willing to work hard in order to continue to be as meaningful as possible. And each one of us have their goals or their special meaning that they feel connected to, and they're willing to fight and they're willing to work hard in order to be as meaningful as possible. And that helps, and I think if I really, on a deeper level, that friend of mine that I was saying how he was trying to avoid sitting on a wheelchair, I think he didn't realize how meaningful his life could be, and how meaningful a life he could continue to live, and how important it is for him to continue to be meaningful. And that's something that we could all do as well. All of us have meaning, all of us have special things that only we can do. And we have to realize how meaningful it is for us to continue to be as meaningful as possible. I want to show you one last clip. I think for this maybe we should turn off the lights because it's a little bit longer. Doesn't have to be there. Just here in front of there. This clip was shown on one of the main Israeli channels and on the news around Itai's Bar Mitzvah. Challenges in our lives, and it's up to us to decide how we deal with those challenges. Many times people feel that the challenges are too strong, and they get depressed, they feel sorry for themselves, and they don't really get very far with it. And I think the ability to deal and cope with challenges is up to us. We all have the ability to deal with any challenge that we're faced. And it's up to us to realize and to figure out what the best way to deal with the challenge that we're faced with in order to continue. We get a toolbox of different ways to cope with different problems. Sometimes it could be a story, it could be a sentence, it could be a phrase, it could be whatever it is for that person that will help him to overcome whatever challenge he has to deal with. I gave an example about the phrase I heard from my Rosh Hashiva, but it could have been anything else with anyone else. And that ability to deal and to overcome the challenges is up to us. It's up to our decision. If we want to overcome it, we will be able to do so. There's a saying. When I was in rehab, there was a soldier who was critically injured about a year before our accident, and his situation then wasn't very good. It's not really good now either. And when I was talking to his father once, he said to me, "There's a saying that Hashem does not try, those he doesn't know, that they won't be able to overcome whatever challenge. He tells me, I don't like deadline. I said, I hear you, I don't like deadline either. I said, what is the line that you do like? He said, Hashem only tries those that he knows will succeed. I said, what's the difference? It's the same thing. He said, no, that one is a negative sentence and this is a positive one. And I think understanding that there are positive outcomes, there are positive ways of looking at the same situation, and as difficult as it might be and as challenging as it might be, we have an ability and we have a way to overcome them. And even when it seems very complicated, it seems almost impossible, we remind ourselves and we remember how meaningful it might be and how meaningful we are and how meaningful our life is, and that gives us the motivation to overcome that challenge. And I think that's the real goal of the challenge. The challenge wasn't given for us to see how it will push us down, rather how we could overcome it and get over it, or deal with it at least, and continue to the best of our ability to be as meaningful as possible. So I would like to wish you that you won't have any challenges. But if I want to be realistic, I'll say that hopefully the challenges will be as easy as possible, and you should be able to overcome them and be as successful as possible with them. Thank you very much for listening. If there are any questions, we have time for some questions. If there are any questions, then please.
Anybody has a question which is pertinent to the general audience, Brian is happy to take a question or two which is pertinent to everyone. He is also happy, after Maariv, to stay and greet every single one of you, Baruch Hashem, his special driver, Grace Yogi, special shout out. Yogi is not going anywhere until next week, so they have a whole night to talk to Ephraim. So anybody who would like to speak to him is more than welcome. He's going to be staying after Maariv to talk to anybody who would like. Shabbos, we have a beautiful Shabbos in West Rogers Park. We thank Hillel Torah, Ari Crown, Ida Crown, and the Fasting Yeshiva High School for all hosting Ephraim together with the Kol this weekend. Any questions for the group? Happy to take.
I know all of your names. I could
exactly. We won't call you out. We'll invite you to the main school for Mark, and Ephraim will take greet everyone afterwards. Thank you all for coming. Sure.
Why don't we all come into the show? It's ready.